around WNYC in New York. This is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a quick recap of the coverage of the Democratic National Convention. I know last week I suggested that maybe too many reporters were going to be covering this thing, and maybe too many did. But this was an historic event, and it was the job of the news media, especially cable news, to remind us of that. Frequently, to tell us what the speakers should say and how we should feel about it. And when there was nothing else to talk about, there was always the Clintons.
The Clinton anger, disappointment saga, is that going to dominate today in these next 3 days?
The Washington Post said Obama personally dislikes Clinton. Do you think that's real and they just need to do this?
Yeah, well, the Clintons got to get over it. The Clinton supporters have to get over it. We can't have 3 nights of the Clintons and 1 night of Barack Obama.
That narrative petered out when the Clintons finally spoke. But when the talkers ran out of topics, they could always talk about themselves. For instance, at Fox News, America's election headquarters, Bill O'Reilly spent a chunk of prime convention time venting about a newspaper that insulted him. He also spoke with a Fox reporter who had a very scary encounter with convention demonstrators.
So these are anarchists. They hate America. Did you ever feel in any danger out there with them?
Well, I did feel a little bit of danger. I felt that they were...
Meanwhile, over at MSNBC, the place for politics, the anchors didn't so much talk about themselves as squabble amongst themselves. Chris Matthews griped at Keith Olbermann when he made a yakety-yak hand gesture directed at Matthews.
Make that sound, Keith. I can do the same to you, okay? That's what I thought, all right?
Olbermann sneered at Joe Scarborough, the token conservative anchor, and Scarborough... Well, it's hard to describe what he did to David Schuster.
Independent? Why, I bet everybody in MSNBC has independent on their voting cards. Oh, we're down the middle now.
The best political team on television, kept it together. It was bland and civil and centrist and won the ratings war. At the two other channels, the coverage was rather more political. Fox anchors leaned predictably to the right, though they did have on a few liberals, even Dennis Kucinich, to spice up the proceedings. But the only conservatives on the liberal MSNBC were on the payroll, Scarborough and Pat Buchanan. At least they're the only ones I saw. But there was a lot I didn't see. For instance, when I was watching Fox, I didn't see Al Gore's speech or Stevie Wonder's performance, though I did see Michael McDonald's. Searched the three cable news channels, I was not given a chance to see John Kerry's speech or Kucinich's or Evan Bayh's. Instead, I was treated to obsessive analysis of the Clinton dissension and an endless parade of prescriptions for the key speakers. Here's Carl Bernstein on CNN prescribing for Obama.
He has somewhat of a problem in terms of being regarded as formidable. That's the task, if there's any, that he's going to be measured by tonight, I think.
MSNBC, the place for politics, was also the place for political spoilers. First, Olbermann blew the big surprise that Obama was going to appear after Joe Biden's speech. And then the next day, Olbermann read part of Obama's speech to an increasingly irritated crowd.
Another excerpt from the Obama speech to come. I say to the American people, to Democrats and Republicans and independents across this great land, enough. It is a strong and specific speech, Chris. So without spoiling any more of that speech, I think we get a tone here.
After Obama's speech, true to form, the pundits told us how to feel about it. This week, the cable news talkers told us that Obama had to reveal himself, but so did the news channels. They all saw this week as promotion for themselves as much as Obama, and they tried to tell us how to feel about them. But I don't feel that good, frankly, because they got in the way of the story, because they made themselves the story. Because if this truly was the historic event they kept telling us it was, then they all talked way too much.
From sea to shining sea.
And it is that promise that 45 years ago today brought Americans from every corner of this land to stand together on a mall in Washington before Lincoln's memorial and hear a young preacher from Georgia speak of his dream.
In becoming the first African-American to win a major party nomination for President of the United States, Barack Obama stands on a tall mountain of civil rights pioneers who came before him. It was particularly appropriate that his acceptance speech fell 45 years to the day after Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream address at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. Less discussed this past week, however, was the debt to African-American women, Fannie Lou Hamer, Shirley Chisholm, Barbara Jordan, and countless others who fought at great risk to make black voices heard in our democracy and who themselves embraced the bully pulpit of the Democratic Convention. Melissa Harris Lacewell is Associate Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. She says Obama would be wise to acknowledge their place in Democratic history, small d and large. Melissa, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Let's start with Fannie Lou Hamer, a Mississippi sharecropper who risked life and limb registering Southern blacks to vote.
Fannie Lou Hamer, we probably best remember from when she actually addressed the Democratic National Convention's Credentials Committee. She was at that time leading the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. It was a party that challenged the idea that any delegation coming in from the Democratic Party to the convention from Mississippi could be all white. Of course, we know the demographics of Mississippi. It is a profoundly African-American state, and yet they were sending delegations that were all white. And so the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was a group of incredibly courageous men and women, led by Fannie Lou Hamer, a woman who was herself born into grinding poverty, the granddaughter of slaves. And when she spoke to the Credentials Committee, she told the story of having been beaten and injured and abused simply for attempting to register to vote.
Mr. Chairman, and to the Credentials Committee, my name is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, and I live at 626 East Lafayette Street, Roosevelt, Mississippi. If the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily? Because we want to live as decent human beings in America.
Fannie Lou Hamer dramatized and gave voice and person to the persecution of blacks in the South. And it is shortly thereafter that Lyndon Johnson makes a choice to sign the Voting Rights Act of 1965. I do believe that part of that is related to the experiences in Atlantic City, New Jersey, where that party convention was held.
Let's move on to the late Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm, who in 1972, when Barack Obama was 11, was a candidate, albeit a hopeless one, for the Democratic presidential nomination.
Well, you know, this is not as though it's Shirley Chisholm is the Hillary Clinton of this convention. It's not as though she got close, and it's not as though there was some concession on her part. Instead, what there was simply her marking her own place in history, making a claim towards herself as an unbought and unbossed woman.
I stand before you today as a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the presidency of the United States. I am not the candidate of Black America, although I am black and proud. I am not the candidate of the women's movement of this country, although I am a woman, and I'm equally proud of that. I stand before you today to repudiate the ridiculous notion that the American people will not vote for a qualified candidate simply because he is not white or because she is not a male.
She was a congressman from New York's 12th District. She served 7 years there and ran in 1972 in the first presidential election after we gave the right to vote to 18 to 21-year-olds. So she is also linked to the question of the youth vote, new voters coming into the electorate and saying, if we're going to have new voters, maybe we could have a new sort of candidate.
Barack Obama burst onto the national scene 4 years ago with his keynote address at the convention. But he wasn't the first African-American politician to do that. 28 years earlier, in 1976, there was Barbara Jordan, who was also a phenomenal orator, and she also held audiences in her thrall. Tell me about that moment.
Barbara Jordan, who was the first African-American woman sent to the U.S. Congress from the state of Texas, spoke about herself as the fulfillment of an American promise, that for her to be there as a black woman from the South, an elected official with the opportunity to address her party in prime time, was an indication of the progress that the country had made.
What is different? What is special? I, Barbara Jordan, am a keynote speaker, and I feel that notwithstanding the past, that my presence here is one additional bit of evidence that the American dream need not forever be deferred.
Now, I must ask you, apart from Shirley Chisholm and Barbara Jordan and Fannie Lou Hamer, in Obama's acceptance speech, he did not even mention Martin Luther King by name.
Yeah, he just called him a young preacher.
A young Georgia preacher. What was your take on the indirectness of the question of race, on which the entire election could turn?
I do think there's a problem when you invoke Kennedy by name, but not King by name, and where you can talk about the historic moment that is Hillary Clinton's campaign, but you don't mention Shirley Chisholm. We've got to have a better historical memory as a country that allows all of the players to be there and all of us to have a place at the kind of table of American history. You know, we do it when we talk about the military. We point out that it's not just that our country has good ideas, it's also that it has young men and women who are willing to sacrifice their lives to protect the security of our country. And every time someone invoked the veterans during this week, there were standing ovations, as is correct. But it's not just a matter of our ability to protect ourselves against foreign enemies. It was also the ways in which domestically we were enemies to democracy ourselves, and that we had warriors here who did that work. And they deserved to be recognized as well.
Melissa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Melissa Harris-Lacewell is Associate Professor of Politics and African American Studies at Princeton University.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Now that the Democratic convention is over, the Republicans are preparing for their grand old party in the Twin Cities. Both parties realize that they have to reckon with the impact of race in this election, but they don't really know how we feel about race, and the fact is, neither do we. Psychologist researchers have spent more than a decade searching for the answer, testing millions of people using something called the implicit association test, and they've found that nearly 80% of whites respond more positively to whites. And so do 30% of blacks. Here's how the test works. On a computer, you are asked to place, quickly as you can, positive words like love or success next to black faces and negative words like agony or failure next to white faces. Then you are asked to switch negative for positive, white for black. Your reaction time is then measured. If your reaction time is shorter when you say match the positive words with the white faces, that's your natural association. Over and over, millions of times, the test demonstrates hidden biases when it comes to not just race, but age, weight, gender, etc. University of Washington psychologist Tony Greenwald created the implicit association test. He explains why even one-third of black respondents react more favorably to whites.
Black respondents were evenly divided, with about a third favoring white, a third favoring black, and a third right in the middle with no preference at all. I think this is a consequence of the black respondents who have taken our test. They are reflecting the dominant culture in their responses, and they're probably reflecting a lot of favorable exposures to white people. Whites in our culture, on the other hand, do not have often a lot of experience with black people, and most of their experiences with blacks are through entertainment and news media, where the presentations are often not favorable. White people who have close friendships with black people do not show this pattern. They may show a favorability to black on our test.
You took the test on race, and the results have changed over time. What did you find?
Well, I created the test about 12 or 13 years ago, and the result I got from it so surprised me that I immediately concluded this was going to be a very interesting test and started to do research on it. And I've probably taken it a few hundred times since then. I know the faces that are on the test like they're old family friends. And I do respond much faster to the test than I used to. And my automatic preference, which I won't confess, but you can guess, shows up more mildly than it used to. But it's remarkable that it nevertheless is still there. It's something I don't want, but I've got.
You know, I read a piece today in the Concord Monitor about a columnist who wrote that she showed a rare preference for African Americans over whites, and she's white. She guessed it was because she'd spent the morning researching Barack Obama and pondering the impact of race in the election. Also, I read that respondents who were shown a picture of Martin Luther King before taking the test generally showed less bias against African Americans. So this has to do with immediate prior exposure before taking the test.
That's true. What you described was something done in a laboratory experiment that I was involved with, but we don't think that will last too long. If one had those experiences over and over again, yes, there might be an enduring change, but we actually don't get those experiences over and over again in our media.
So generally, I think that the media are given way too much credit for moving the culture. I generally think it's much more of a reflection of the culture. But you're suggesting that the media may be able to fundamentally change our implicit biases if they offer us enough favorable images.
The media can do this, but I actually don't think the media are prepared to do this. They're not prepared to say, okay, we're not going to present crime as a black phenomenon. We're not going to put on entertainment programming in which the criminals are more likely to be black than white. That's just not going to happen. On the other hand, if we get a black president, the media will have no choice but to present the black race in a very different way than it's been presented in the past.
Is there anything that political strategists can take away from your research?
First, let me say, whenever you hear a politician say, you know, it's the policies that are going to influence the voters, taxation, healthcare, education, social security, et cetera, you know, my research doesn't take me there at all. I think it's not the policies. I think it's the simple associations. For example, what do we know about Biden? Well, some people know details about him. But if there's a soundbite that he came away with, it's goes home to Wilmington every night. That's a great soundbite in terms of associating him with good things like home. And notice he's not associated with Washington, D.C., which some politicians want to distance themselves from, but rather Wilmington. And I heard a phrase at the convention that I am sure is going to come up a lot, and that is a race for the future. For Obama to get an association of himself with the future and try to link McCain to the past, those are simple associations that could work very well. And if you're going to have a race, you actually want a young guy to be doing the running.
So what do you think we can take away from this research? That most of us are on some subconscious level just immovably racist? I mean, that's depressing.
I wouldn't say that. I do think that we have associations with race that will influence our behavior, even though we don't want those associations to influence our behavior. In fact, I'm convinced that race is importantly involved in this presidential election. Just how it's going to play out, we don't exactly know. We are in uncharted territory. We have never had a campaign and an election like this.
Tony, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for being interested, Brooke.
Tony Greenwald is a professor of psychology at the University of Washington in Seattle. He created the implicit association test with colleagues at the University of Virginia and Harvard University. We'll link to the test from our site on themedia.org.
Remember Harry and Louise? They first emerged in 1993 in ads opposing the Clinton administration's plan for health care reform. They really worried about health care.
But this was covered under our old plan. that was a good one, wasn't it?
Well, last week, Harry and Louise returned to the small screen, and they're as anxious as ever.
Healthcare costs are up again. Small companies are being forced to cut their plans.
Tell me about it.
During the Clinton-era healthcare reform debates, Harry and Louise reckoned the problem was government bureaucrats.
They choose.
We lose.
Now, 15 years later, they just can't wait for Washington to get its hands on healthcare.
Whoever the next president is, healthcare should be at the top of his agenda.
Harry and Louise used to be the hired guns of the health insurance and small business lobbies. Now they answer to the other side, a coalition of groups led by Families USA. WNYC's Fred Mogul takes a look.
They're a dream couple, but their new sponsors are strange bedfellows. Families USA, a consumer advocacy group, is sharing credit with the National Federation of Independent Business, one of the original Clinton-bashing Harry and Louise backers. Also on the team are two major hospital trade groups and the patient-oriented American Cancer Society. Each has a competing approach to getting people health coverage. Together, they're a little bit like a resurrected reunion tour comprised of the Carpenters, Led Zeppelin, and Liberace. Ron Pollack of Families USA.
I think this is a sign that more and more organizations are prepared to work together because the healthcare crisis has grown so substantially.
It's not exactly clear what he means by work together. Though these lobbies didn't mention it when they launched the ad earlier this month, several of them have been meeting to hammer out differences on and off for years while the number of uninsured Americans continues to climb. They typically agree on some broad goals, like making sure everyone has health insurance, without resolving the thornier specifics, like what to do about individuals with pre-existing conditions. Their ad has only one simple call to action.
Whoever the next president is, healthcare should be at the top of his agenda. Bring everyone to the table and make it happen.
Americans are ultimately really nice people. They want to make sure people have coverage who don't have health insurance coverage.
Molly Ann Brody follows public opinion and healthcare policy for the Kaiser Family Foundation.
The hard part breaks down when it comes to trying to figure out the best solution to those goals.
Brody says the ad is a reflection of the anxiety shared by these often conflicting groups that their issue is being eclipsed. In a recent Gallup poll, healthcare lost its gold medal spot as America's top worry, falling slightly behind the economy for a close silver. Throw in gas prices and Iraq, and the question is,
is there a chance that the focus on healthcare reform, could that fall off a public agenda?
The new ad sponsors were open about this concern at the press conference. What they didn't acknowledge was that the plot line of Harry and Louise return, and this time they're for government reform, is itself a rerun from 8 years ago. As those presidential primaries were getting underway, the couple briefly appeared in support of Clinton initiatives to expand coverage for the poor with $30 billion worth of tax credits. News reports at the time played up the couple's surprising shift toward government-oriented health care. But Slate columnist Timothy Noah says it wasn't really a surprise, not then and not now.
They were never anti-government, per se. They were anti-regulation. They were very much in favor of any scheme that would subsidize the insurance industry. The insurers weren't really giving a lot up because these were people who, by definition, couldn't afford health insurance on their own, and they also were more likely to be unhealthy, so they didn't present themselves as terribly promising customers.
The ad buy 8 years ago was much smaller and came at a much less dramatic moment than the 1993 campaign, but it did spark a brief spate of news stories. Still, that revival was quickly forgotten, so that by last week's re-reemergence, most stories read or sounded like this one on CBS.
Well, Harry and Louise are back, but this time, Wyatt Andrews reports, they're on the other side of the issue.
It's certainly a time-honored way of amplifying a low-budget, limited-release ad. Make it news. Dusting off the Harry and Louise brand and pretending it's the first time they've surfaced in 15 years has worked like a charm.
Obviously, a lot of people in the American public still know of Harry and Louise and actually enjoyed the irony that now they are supporting health care reform.
Ron Pollack of Families USA.
We were pretty confident that we would get a great deal of free, or some people call it earned media, over and above the paid media through our advertising. And indeed, that was the case.
So the ironic twist of Harry and Louise's conversion from bane of reform to booster was really business as usual. Perhaps the real irony is that the media fell for it again and missed the chance to ask what reform might really look like, what each of the ad sponsors really wants, and what keeps them and us from getting a solution. For On the Media, I'm Fred Mogul.
The national conversation about energy independence should be a wide-ranging discussion about science and economics, but mostly it's framed as a political debate with two equal and opposing sides. But do both sides warrant equal attention? David Fitterer writes for the Huffington Post and has been a banker in the energy industry for two decades. He's been following the coverage, and his complaint is that reporters who lack a basic understanding of the energy economy act as unwitting enablers for politicians who trample on the facts to gain political advantage.
An example I wrote about in the Huffington Post was John Harwood, who writes for the New York Times and is also a political correspondent for CNBC, talked about how the Democrats now are talking about building new nuclear plants because gasoline is selling at $4 a gallon.
And there is no relationship between the price of oil at the pumps and nuclear anything, correct?
That's correct. Nuclear is used for generating electricity. Oil is used in the United States primarily for transportation, and there's no viable way of converting nuclear energy into fuel for transportation.
Now, since both John McCain and Barack Obama and every other national politician are talking about energy independence, can we just establish a few things about that premise?
Like, sure.
Given the way petroleum deposits are distributed on Earth, is it reasonable to imagine the U.S. being fully independent of foreign oil, ever?
Not if we consume oil at anything close to the rate we have for the last 50 years. If we consumed oil at the rate we did in 1965, we would still be importing 40% of our oil.
Another contentious issue is that of offshore oil reserves.
Yes.
The Republicans want to start drilling tomorrow, and they portray those against more drilling as tree huggers willing to put our nation's energy security at risk to save a few whales. At least that's how the media has been framing the controversy.
Even if all the oil reserves were there that the most optimistic oil person says is off the coast of California or Florida, it still wouldn't have a major impact on the price of oil. It still would take, at best, 5 years to bring production to market, and it still wouldn't change our dependence on foreign oil in any major way.
Now, you write for the Huffington Post. It is
right.
An unabashedly liberal website. Are you giving me a political point of view, or is that an undisputed fact that you've just recited?
Oh, that's an undisputed fact. You don't hear the president of Exxon saying, oh, if we started drilling offshore, oil prices would go down within the next few months. No one in the industry believes that.
So why then does the press frame this issue as dueling policy options? It reminds me a bit of the so-called global warming debate. Even though there was a scientific consensus that man was affecting the environment, the press almost compulsively framed it as battling viewpoints. Is that what's happening here? The press looking to be fair and in so doing distorting reality?
Yeah, I think the Republicans are framing the debate and the media is going along saying, okay, this is the Republicans' perspective and this is the Democrats' perspective and that's just the way it is. But that is not the underlying reality.
So when you watch a reporter, you know, taking the hook and running with it, what are you thinking?
I think sometimes they're just carrying water for politicians. When Lou Dobbs asked Bill Schneider, well, oil prices dropped. It's just what all the experts said. Once President Bush stopped the executive order to ban offshore drilling, oil prices fell 13% over the last two or three weeks. Isn't that impressive? Well, no one in the industry believes that. There were no experts who believed that. And that's because, with or without an executive order, it's still illegal to drill offshore for opening.
And Bill Schneider, having been confronted with that premise,
he said something to that effect: yes, two-thirds of Americans support offshore oil drilling now. Bill Schneider, a pollster, takes a polling question, and if the majority of Americans believe it, it's referenced as if it were a demonstrable fact.
So you're the Sultan. What are your marching orders?
When someone says that they are going to reduce our dependence on offshore oil, have that person actually walk us through the numbers. A political consultant can walk you through how you get to 270 electoral votes in the fall. Someone who has an energy plan should be able to walk you through how do you reduce our dependence on foreign oil.
David, thank you.
Thanks.
David Fitterer, for 20 years an energy banker, has been writing about energy issues for the Huffington Post.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Wallace Foundation, whose Knowledge Center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield, with the winner of the first ever On the Media T-shirt design contest from Cincinnati, Ohio, Mr. Phil Mastman. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Your design, which we love, borrows the 3D glasses image that we have at the top of our website. This is people in a movie theater watching the movie with those, you know, the cardboard specs. On one side is that image, and then superimposed is the phrase "edited by Brooke" in big letters, and just On the Media on the back. We're actually going to flip that around, though I did vote for your design, seeing Brooke's name emblazoned large on somebody's chest is much more than I can bear.
Hey, you're the one who did the show topless this month.
Yeah, well, and it was delicious. Phil, what inspired you to do this design?
Well, Bob, after listening to you read the credits at the end of the show for all these years with that just wonderfully smarmy delivery of edited by Brooke, I just thought it couldn't be anything else.
Tell us about yourself, Phil. What do you do in real life?
Well, I am a television commercial director here in Cincinnati. I actually had the great honor of having one of my commercials reviewed by Bob in his other job at Ad Age.
Oh, my God.
As the world's most powerful advertising critic?
Absolutely, and I have to say that he slammed me terribly, but it was still an honor just the same.
I apologize. It was probably nothing personal.
What was the ad about?
It was for the Fifth Third Bank here in Cincinnati. It was five or six years ago. Do you remember that? And they used the character Mini-Me in a commercial. And Bob took issue with that.
Well, my apologies, Phil. I'll see that that doesn't happen again. Although if you keep calling me smarmy, you're a little more vulnerable than you otherwise might be.
Phil, do you have any questions for us?
Well, I would love to know the story behind this delivery that Bob does at the end of the show every time. I'm sure there's got to be some inside story to it.
Do you know that we have gotten, over the 8 years we've done this show, more letters about that than any other single thing?
Phil, I'd like to accommodate you, but I just can't tell you everything because, truthfully, this is the love that dare not speak its name. But way back when, in the mid-80s, I was doing pieces for All Things Considered. And Brooke was my editor. And, sometimes those editing sessions were a little bit on the contentious side, much as the Civil War was a little on the contentious side. But every single time, save one, I came to understand at the end of the process that my piece had not only been improved, but dramatically improved because it had been edited by Brooke.
Bob did stories about sort of bizarro America, Charles Kuralt style, and there was this friar who basically evangelized on the side of the road and ate what people threw to him, and Bob has him eating a two-day-old taco that he finds on the side of the road, and I felt that it stacked the deck against the friar. Bob will never agree with that edit.
Yeah, Brooke felt that it made this guy who stood outside on the highway for 16 hours a day flagging cars down for Jesus. She thought it made him seem a little odd.
Well, I have to say that if this T-shirt design was the catalyst that finally satisfied all of us listeners' curiosity about that reading of the credits at the end of the program, then it's all worthwhile.
Phil, thank you so much.
Take care, man.
It was a great honor. Thank you.
Phil Massman, TV commercial director from Cincinnati, Ohio, and designer of the first On the Media T-shirt.
Of course, opening up the design process to the crowd is happening elsewhere, by other media outlets, various political groups, or web-friendly bands. All this is made possible through something called print-on-demand technology, which allows the production of small personalized orders, sometimes as small as just one, instead of those huge bulk orders that were necessary until not too long ago. At the center of this personalized print-on-demand universe is the website cafepress.com. Designers upload their work and then order T-shirts, underwear, or even baby bibs stamped with that design. In fact, anyone can search the site and order a product created by anyone else, making the site a sort of crowdsourced catalog that can react to cultural events with remarkable speed. Just 2 days after Barack Obama announced Joe Biden was his running mate, there were 50,000 products promoting the duo. Cafe Press CEO and co-founder Fred Durham says that because Cafe Press handles the production, inventory, promotion, and distribution, users can essentially be their own T-shirt company, as long as their designs are good enough to attract buyers.
So we could actually let people become kind of micro-entrepreneurs selling ideas and T-shirt designs with no money out of pocket because it is made on demand.
I saw one T-shirt that said, "Meat is murder, tasty murder." That made me laugh out loud. And if I am the designer of the "Meat is murder, tasty murder" T-shirt and some third party decides to buy one or 12 of them, do I get a cut?
You do. So we have a base price for the products, and then we let the person who designs it set what the retail price should be. And once a month, we send checks off to the designers for that difference.
In addition to being an ongoing Web 2.0 business, you do double duty as sort of a political barometer, because by monitoring the sales of T-shirts from various points in the political spectrum, you can keep your finger on the pulse of the body politic, at least the body politic that covers its body with T-shirts. Who's doing better in the T-shirt space, Obama or McCain?
Definitely Obama. It's kind of, you're either for Obama or you're not interested in the election. McCain has not garnered through the entire election very much passion and interest from the community at all.
Now, does this augur poorly for John McCain, or is this just sort of a demographic quirk, Obama's audience overlapping with the message T-shirt wearing audience?
If this was our first election, I may think maybe it's a demographic issue. This is the third election we've been through. George Bush merchandise was very hot during the previous election. So unless George Bush skewed young and hip, which I don't think was the case, then that argument doesn't take hold. When we still had Ron Paul and Mike Huckabee, T-shirt sales were much closer to neck and neck. Every time one of the alternative Republican voices dropped off, the sales didn't go to McCain, but Obama's grew by just about the exact amount. The trends we've seen make kind of the T-shirt polls a very telling, perhaps even better than standard poll, view of what's really happening and where the elections are headed.
I just got to challenge you on that. Are you serious or just being glib when you say better than a traditional poll?
Just like product research, asking people what they think of products is a poor predictor of what people are actually going to buy. What we find with T-shirts, these aren't your average people at home. These are the enthusiasts who are definitely going to show up and pull the poll lever. The election's not about the mood of the nation. It's about those who actually get out and vote.
Sloganeering can be a powerful tool, and the T-shirt is a perfect medium for it. But I'm curious if there's things that you won't print on a T-shirt.
There are. You know, that's a big debate here at Cafe Press. We weed out too much love and too much hate, basically. So no porn, no hate stuff. because people stop showing up if you let certain people kind of dominate the conversation.
Now, I was going through your site, and you know, I was continued to be freshly amazed at how clever ordinary civilians can be.
I really liked several years ago, there's a college intramural basketball team. Happened to be they were all Native Americans in Colorado, and they just created this kind of, you know, dorm pickup basketball team called the Fighting Whites. And they're making fun of the, you know, kind of fighting Indian sort of slogans. And they had this sort of 1950s white guy clip art on the T-shirt, and it turned into a massive media frenzy. And I just loved it because, with, you know, Rush Limbaugh talked about it, but of course, you know, the liberal side talked about it too, and everyone had respect for this thing that felt like it should be controversial, but was just funny and amazing and touching and, you know, patriotic all at the same time. I don't know how you can mix more together with the Fighting Whites.
Now, we've all seen phenomena like OK Go, the fairly obscure music group that broke out because of their treadmill dance on YouTube. Are there any Cafe Press stars that have risen from obscurity on the basis of a T-shirt design?
We certainly had pop culture phenomena. We had one that was pretty big, Free Katie, Katie Holmes. When Tom Cruise was, you know, jumping up and down on the sofa on Oprah, Free Katie, here's a huge design. And we had one called American Apology with President Bush. Somebody wrote, you know, I'm sorry I didn't vote for him, in many languages, so you could wear that around the world when you're flying around to let them know you weren't a supporter. And that really took off.
And is there anything that has taken off, you know, more or less to your political chagrin?
To my political chagrin? Yeah, I can't think of anything. Everything I've seen that has taken off, it's taken off because ultimately the social fabric of America cares about substance, believe it or not, even when it doesn't look that way. And I think freedom of expression is one of the core principles of America, and it works.
Concerning the social fabric, is it 100% cotton or a cotton poly blend?
We're cotton. Yeah, all cotton.
All right, Fred. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fred Durham is the co-founder and CEO of CafePress.com.
Amid the convention coverage this week were remembrances of another historic gathering of Democrats 40 years ago, August 1968. After a time of unprecedented upheaval, Democrats convened in Chicago to select a presidential candidate, Mark Kurlansky, author of 1968, The Year That Rocked the World, remembers the prevailing narrative of that day.
The narrative of the 68 Democratic Convention was an incredible year-long drama, this movement to try to shift the Democratic Party from the party of Lyndon Johnson and the Vietnam War to an anti-war party. Lyndon Johnson decided not to run for re-election, and suddenly there was a very viable, a likely winner of the Democratic nomination in Robert Kennedy, who was probably going to stop the war.
The country wants to move in a different direction. We want to deal with our own problems within our own country, and we want peace in Vietnam.
Robert Kennedy was killed, leaving the question of what would happen to his delegates. And by the time they got into the convention, Hubert Humphrey, who was seen as kind of a yes man for Lyndon Johnson, was going to get in.
President Johnson has accomplished more of the unfinished business of America than any of his modern predecessors. And tonight, to you, Mr. President, I say thank you. Thank you, Mr. President.
All of this anti-war fight that had built with so much drama during the past year was going to be for nothing.
So there were these plans to demonstrate in Chicago. Principally, they were planned by the Mobilization Against the War and the Youth International Party, or the Yippies. The Yippies seemed to be less of a political movement than they were a cultural statement.
It was this idea of street theater as politics. And Abby Hoffman in particular was absolutely brilliantly wacky.
And you say, look, you know, what we really need is a revolution. We really got to overthrow the country. See, we want money, we want guns, we want dynamite, lollipops, acid, dope, everything.
This was the man who in 1967, with the march against the Pentagon, had threatened to make the Pentagon levitate and spin. And he actually got the media to cover this, to stand by and watch to see if the Pentagon was going to levitate and spin.
We'd never fall for that now.
Which, of course, it didn't, you know. And then they turned to Abbie Hoffman and said, well, Mr. Hoffman, what went wrong? You know, and he just laughed.
And there was certainly a media savvy applied to the situation in Chicago. The unofficial motto of the Yippies was, do what you want when you want to, but make sure to get photographed. So how did the violence play on TV?
Well, pretty much everybody had expected violence because Daley and the Chicago police had been very brutal in the race riots that happened after Martin Luther King's assassination in April, and the same month there had been an anti-war demonstration in Chicago in which the Chicago police just beat up everybody.
Gentlemen, get the thing straight once and for all. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
In fact, Jesse Jackson had urged black people not to go simply because, you know, police beating up black people was not the effective television that police beating up white people would be.
That's pretty sad and cynical.
Yeah, yeah. The curious thing historically about all of this is that Daley and his people didn't have any concern about the media coverage.
We are ready at this time, and we have been, to meet the terrorists who are going all over this country, creating incidents like they created in Chicago. And they should be exposed and uncovered, and we hope we can get the cooperation of the press and television and radio to do it.
I don't think that they really understood the impact of it, because almost all demonstrations in 1968 all over the world were suppressed with police violence. But up until that point, you hadn't seen it that much.
The convention itself was playing out during another event, the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, after a period of reform known as the Prague Spring. That also transfixed people around the world and captured the headlines.
The Prague Spring began in the first week of 1968 when a man named Alexander Dubček became the new head of the Czech government, a dedicated Slovak communist.
But also kind of a likable little schlub.
He believed in the whole dream of communism and that it was a liberating process. He believed in having a dialogue with the people and that it would be the people's government. And so the first thing that he did when he came to power is he asked the people of Czechoslovakia, what do they want their government to be? And they told him that they wanted freedom of the press and they wanted freedom to travel and they wanted all of these liberties. And none of this was a discussion about dismantling communism. That was not even on the table.
And so this idealistic communist decided to grant those privileges in order to advance the cause of communism and make it more responsive to its people.
And it riveted the world because here was this communist government saying, yes, we're a communist government, but, you know, we have democratic values. It was called communism with a human face. And this was tremendously exciting, especially to young people all over the world. And then on the night of August 20th and in the morning of August 21st, the Soviet Union invaded their ally and crushed this whole thing.
Czech television journalists working underground spoke of Russian and Czech security police working together to arrest well-known citizens. According to other reports, the arrests were concentrated among journalists and people prominent in cultural life.
It really was, as Gorbachev pointed out some years later, the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union, because it showed people that, contrary to the promise of communism, no reform was possible, and therefore there was no hope.
And so here was this story of absolutely volcanic importance happening halfway around the world. Most of America's leading reporters were, like now, at the convention. And you note that Daniel Schorr, an NPR yes. senior correspondent who was at CBS at that time and had opened the CBS Moscow Bureau, was reluctantly pulled away from the convention story.
Yes, he told me he was very upset about this. You know, he was being dragged away from the big story. But covering a political convention in 1968 was very different than covering a political convention today. It really was news. You didn't know what was going to happen. You didn't know who was going to get nominated. You didn't know what kind of fights were going to take place. In 1968, the media went to Chicago expecting to see a huge explosion and to cover it. In 2008, the media is going to Denver expecting to see a media show.
Thank you very much, Mark.
My pleasure.
Mark Kurlansky is author of 1968, The Year That Rocked the World.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson, engineering help from Zach Marsh, and more help from Michael Bernstein and archivist Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from The Dial Press, publisher of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, a novel by Marianne Schaefer and Annie Barrows. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.